I obsessed on the Pope for 6 months one time. And these people that are obsessing on communists all the time, and they're everything they do is obsessive compulsive, and they're going to get there, and they see communists everywhere. These are thought disorders. These are thought disorders. Detailing. I had a woman come to my office one time, and her presenting problem was that she was boring the people. So I said, well, tell me about that. And within 15 minutes, I was nodding off. And I said, wait a minute. I'm getting bored here. And here's what she did. She started talking. She said, well, you know, I was coming over here today, and I walked down through the kitchen, and I looked over, and the white cornmeal had the top off of it, so I went over to close it up. Of course, I really like yellow cornmeal, and so does Biffy and Spiff. But we can't get yellow cornmeal because Kroger's, you remember when Kroger's closed down? And now Weingarten's and Eckerd's, they don't have the yellow cornmeal. They don't have the stone ground cornmeal that we really like. We used to get that in Minnesota. My dad knew a guy named Billy Crunchgaw in Wisconsin who knew about stone ground cornmeal. And 15 minutes, we're not even out of the kitchen yet. I'm thinking this therapy's going to take 40 years. This woman I subsequently found out had been terribly battered by her father. He held her at gunpoint in the home till she was 27 years old because he wouldn't let her leave. And so, of course, one of the ways to get out of your feelings is to go up in your head. And if you can obsess on detail, so you're sleuthing around trying to catch your alcoholic husband, and you're in your head all the time obsessing on details, and you're generalizing. These are all ways to stay out of feelings. And they're all protections against feelings. And some of you have seen the movie we did in Los Angeles, It's Not My Problem, how all of those people will be so obsessing on their partner that they don't deal with any of their own stuff. That's codependency. So, the unmanageability, you worry about the most trivial and silly things. You obsess on them. You ruminate. You seem to never find clear answers, and you have a hard time with decisions. Life is a problem to be solved rather than a mystery to be lived. You're always, everything you think you can figure out. See, one of the problems of dysfunctional families is you always think you can figure it out. If I can just figure it out, then this family will be okay. You stop thinking about what someone's, you can't stop thinking about what someone said. You can't stop worrying about someone else's problem. I can't stop thinking about that, you say. You worry a lot. You worry over things you have no control over, the past, the future, the communists, the church, the Pope. You abandon your needs because you're so worried about something. You're perfectionistic to the point of driving other people easy. You're obsessive compulsive with details, and that's really offender behavior, that kind of compulsivity, that obsessive compulsivity. Just drive people crazy. Sometimes we just have people drive us crazy over details. Disabled will, experienced as willfulness. So the D, the N is noetic disorders, the D is disabled will. It's experienced as willfulness, self-will run riot, control madness. Also experienced as grandiosity, willing absolutes. You will happiness instead of one day at a time and stuff you have control over. The will is cut off from judgment, reasoning, and imagination through emotional blockage. The will has no content but itself. The deepest problem in all addiction is the addiction to your own will. This has been not talked about a lot, but it's really important. Leslie Faber is a psychiatrist who's written a great deal about this, the addiction to our own will. In the programs, we say self-will run riot, or we talk about grandiosity. But see, really, it's because you can't think when you're biased by emotion. Those of us who are emotionally shut down and psychically numbed out, we just knocked out our 3 trillion circuited computer. Because there's so much stuffed emotion in there, the brain can't function. Now, the will needs the intellect to look at alternatives, to reason, to make judgments. And most of us learn to use our imagination catastrophically. That is, we don't imagine healthy alternatives. We imagine catastrophic things. You know, we can think of the darndest things. Don Juan teaches Carlos Castaneda that you can make yourself happy or miserable, the amount of work is the same. You can make yourself happy or miserable. You can get on the airplane and say, this is the safest I have been all day. Or you can look out at the fire coming out of the wing. And you can think of a die-hard Japanese kamikaze pilot. And I mean, if you're good at this, boy, can you get creative at catastrophizing. And we learn this at parental knees. We watch our parents catastrophize. We learn to use our imagination negatively. If somebody came to the door and called out one of your names and said, there's a message for you as you walk to the phone. So they may be telling you, won the Reader's Digest sweepstakes. How many would think of that? So, unmanageability. You will what cannot be willed. You try to fix other people. You try to make other people happy. And lots of your questions last night, I read them over when I got home, were about how do I fix my children? And see, those questions are that you fix yourself. The way you heal the world, Elizabeth Kubler Ross says this all the time, if you want to save the world, if you want to heal the world, heal yourself, because you are the world. You are the world. If I will heal me, I can heal the world. But if I'm obsessing on everybody else and my codependent caretaker role, then wrong. Look at the log, not the mote, in the brother's eye. You try to control everything and everybody, known as taking hostages in relationships. You're impulsive, act without thinking, can't make a decision, or can't make a decision. You will to will. You want action and excitement all the time. You believe you can change another person. You're self-centered and insensitive. You expect others to do it your way. You play God, criticize, judge each other. Now, these are not the only behaviors. These are just the ones that I identify with, and I've taken some of these out of Codependent No More, Melody Beattie's book, and Tim and Chermack. I've just tried to, Terry Kellogg, I've tried to make a compilation of these. Then, enmeshed boundaries. The next E is enmeshed boundaries. Experience is not having limits. When a little kid learns to say no, that's a limit. Your anger is a limit. People who are people pleasers and be nice, they become doormats. So I have sex with you so I don't hurt your feelings. It's a boundary problem. I don't have boundaries. You're angry. I don't have to take that on. That's about you and your history. Okay, I may have done something. You may be overreacting to it. I don't have to take on the anger. I can be accountable to you if I'm committed to you, if I care about you, but I don't have to take on your anger. I don't have to do anything to get you not angry at me. Ernie Larson, a guy in Minneapolis who's been around the program, while he talks about a club he was in as a kid in high school, and it was to do dastardly things to girls and make them apologize for what you've done to them. I mean, that's a real sick little club. But what they would do is, like, a guy would stand her up on a date. And then when she'd say, where were you? He'd say, well, after what you said to Tommy Johnson, I'm not taking you out on a date. And she'd go, what do you mean, what I said to... You told Tommy Johnson I was blup blup. I did not. Yes, you did. He told me Saturday. He's making all this up. And the end of this, she starts apologizing. See, so he's now got her. And of course, this goes on in relationships too, by the way. But this is a person with no boundaries will hook into this all the time. And women are taught not to have boundaries. Stand by your man. You light up his life. You're his refuge in the storm. Your job is to help him win. Don't have a life of your own. So you don't have any limits. You have a lack of individuality. Enmeshed boundaries are the basis of most of relationship problems. Nancy and I have boundary issues all the time. When you work together, boundary issues. You've got to establish boundaries. You ever been at work? You worked at a place where they didn't have good job descriptions? That's about boundaries. When I consult with industry, and offices. We talk about good job descriptions, so you have good boundaries. So you don't know where what your body is telling you. You sleep with people you don't like or know. You don't know when you're tired, horny, hungry, or sick. You're not in touch with your body. You don't have a boundary. You're gullible, easily manipulated. You've been conned a lot in your life. It's a boundary problem. You expect others to know what you need, think, or feel. See, not only do we not know what we think or feel, but in codependency, we expect others to. Well, you should have known. Well, if I have to tell you what I need, then it's not worth it. See, most of us are so into our own stuff. If you don't tell me what you need, I don't know what you need. And my life is not dedicated to, to putting you on a pedestal and making you God. You blame yourself. You value others' opinions more than your own. You blame yourself for the reality of others and others for your reality. You're making me sick. You know, you're making me sick. See, kids are taught that you're making your father. You kids are going to kill your mother. See, you're already magical. You're being taught this stuff. You feel embarrassed by the way I act or dress. Couples do this all the time. Nancy gets embarrassed by my green suit. I love my green suit. Now, I do admit that I've learned a lot from her in terms of dressing. I had 11 polyester leisure suits when I married her. And I thought I was the coolest dude that ever came down the pike. And she's helped me to grasp some of that. You like other people in order to be liked. You feel embarrassed by the way I dress. Then the next one, the N, is narcissistic deprivation. Experienced as having a hole in your soul. See, every child needs a mirror there that when you look in the mirror, you're there. For 15 months, we need a parent that is healthy enough to be there for us. If you have a needy parent, they just can't be there for you. If I look in the mirror when I'm in my little velvet suit, I'm there. But when I touch my penis, gone. Out of the mirror. So that part of me gets cut off. My anger gets cut off. So now I'm this good guy who smiles all the time, but I don't have any sex and I don't have any anger. But that's all going on unconsciously, and it's what Hal Stone calls the basis of the demonic. Because all that cut off stuff festers in there and it grows. And so one day a guy comes in my office, he's 45 years old, and he says, I'm having this affair and I don't know how it happened. And I'm saying, how old were you again? 45, and you don't know how you went to bed with this lady? See, he's so cut off from his sexuality. I've had women in therapy with their dresses up to here going, are you feeling sexual? Whoa, no, what are you talking about? So you cut that sexuality off. It operates. It operates, and it gets bigger. And then it starts taking you over. It starts taking you over. So narcissistic deprivation is every one of us needed to be His Majesty the baby for at least 15 months. You treat a baby like a baby when they're a baby, and then you won't have to treat them a baby when they're 50 years old. But if you're narcissistically deprived, you're this whiny little baby who's trying to get those needs met. An adult with an insatiable child living within who can never get enough neediness, seeking praise, admiration, and attention. Because you didn't get it at the right time in the right sequence. So it comes out as you feel needy. You find needy victims who adore you in order to be connected to somebody. When I first began counseling, how I'd be attracted to the most wounded women. And I could feel sorry for them. Or men. But you see, it was always so I could be superior to them and I could get all my narcissistic needs met by them saying they couldn't live without me. And your children, I'm your mother and you can't live. See, a lot of times parents who've been narcissistically deprived will make their children the object of their narcissistic gratification. Your children will never leave you. They'll always love you. They'll always treat you with respect. Alice Miller wrote a book called The Drama of the Gifted Child. The Drama of the Gifted Child. How narcissistically deprived parents form and deform the emotional lives of their children. It's a powerful book. And I recommend it to all of you. Because a lot of high rollers, high achievers have been narcissistically deprived. And the way they're patching up the hole in their soul is by making money, by being important. So, you find needy victims who adore you in order to be connected. You're egocentric, always moving to center stage. You put enormous energy into being righteous and good in everyone's eyes so you can get a lot of adoration. You're an addict and you use your addiction to get your narcissistic supplies. So when I drank, I felt whole. And addicts become very narcissistic. A lot of actors are getting their narcissistic needs. Boy, when they're on the stage, it's like mainline fix. They walk off the stage, they go right into depression. Richard Pryor is in the programs, you know, out in Los Angeles, talks about his cocaine addiction. And Richard was just terribly abused as a child. JoJo Dancer is a movie about his life. JoJo Dancer, Your Life is Calling. And Richard is almost painful to be with. He's so shy. But you see, when he's on that stage, that narcissistic stuff comes on, and lots of actors are like that. It's being an actor. You use your children for your narcissistic lives. You need money, possessions, to feel worth anything. So the more money I've got, then the more worth I am, and the more stuff I've got, then the more worth I am. I'm really worth something. Look at how much I'm worth. And look at all my diamonds, and look at all my jewelry, and look at all my cars. And see, all that's trying to patch up the hole in our soul. Then communication problems. If I don't know who I am and I'm a false self, I'm going to have trouble being aware of what I think, what I feel, and what I want. If you communicate well, you got to know what you feel, think, and want. So here's the way that comes out. You talk too much. Lots of codependents talk too much. Drive you crazy. Trying to control everybody with talk. Believe me, I know about this. Trying to control everybody with talk. A lot of recovering addicts talk all the time. It's like using your mouth to control reality. Or you don't talk at all. You think that what you say is not important, you apologize for bothering people talking. I know you're going to think this is stupid, but let me tell you, and I know this sounds crazy to you, but you're always apologizing for everything you say. You don't talk directly. You say things like, the car needs gas. There's no milk here today. It's cold in here. Anybody identify with this? We need to get the plane tickets, honey. We need to take out the garbage. We've never taken the garbage out as a couple. Nancy doesn't do that. I'm just teasing. She's over there. Don't ask for what you want. You don't say what you mean or mean what you say or know what you mean. You blame, threaten, yell, coerce, beg, bribe, and advise. You use you messages, critical, judgmental, over-responsible statements rather than self-responsible I messages. This is about me and my history. I'm really upset about what's going on right now. It's about me and my history. See, that way I'm not attacking you. You take a long time getting to the point. You say things to please other people, things you think they'd like to hear. Or you do it to provoke them. And then the last one is this inner emptiness. The last E is emptiness. Experience of having no inner reality, no clear identity. And that's one of the ways codependency, Tim and Chermak has it in the DMS. It's a personality problem. You don't have an identity. It's a personality distortion. You don't know who you are. You have no inner reality. Spiritual bankrupt. My life feels like it has happened by chance rather than by choice. So I act as if I know who I am, but I really feel confused or frozen. Another thing I heard Tim and Chermak say is that being codependent is like being the lifeguard on a crowded beach with everyone depending on you, but you don't know how to swim. Believe me, I felt like that as the father of a family. They come, they say, Daddy! And I go, God, y'all are mistaking me for somebody who knows something about this. And I mean, it's like, I feel like a child sometimes. My kids will come to me, I feel like a child myself. I feel like I don't know what to tell them. And you know, I want to be the good father with good, profound information. Of course, that's grandiose, too. But I don't believe compliments given to me, and I don't admire myself. Sometimes your shame will come out the most when you're being admired, when you've just achieved something. I feel unable to change my life the way I want it to be. I don't like to be alone for very long. Or you can't be alone. You got to play the television. You got to do something. You got to make noise. But you just can't be alone because it's so empty in there. I remember one of my last terrible drunks. And some people were with me. And they were trying to, because, you know, I'd really gotten to the point my drinking had become progressive and I was doing crazy things. And they said I would go to the mirror constantly and look in the mirror, almost like a metaphor of, are you really here? I would just almost be compelled to go look in the mirror, try to be sure I was really alive. I'm in an act or performance a lot of the time. I care for others in ways that I don't care for myself. Some of you will do things, you'll have mercy on someone else, you'll be kind and nurturing to someone else, and you will just beat yourself up unmercifully. I fear getting too close to anyone for too long because they might find out. See, and that's why the ultimate problem in codependency, it's a terrible relational problem. And that one of the characteristics that'll fit anybody who's codependency is you don't know a bloody thing about intimacy. We just don't, because that shame is I'm in hiding and I'm too scared to reveal myself except up to a point. And when it gets to that point, boy, then you'll see the games. Eric Byrne found that the games people play came out of when the intimacy voltage got raised. That's when the games come. Because it's so scary to have someone see you as you are, because we've all been hurt. We've all been abandoned. So to risk letting somebody see me in this vulnerable little child, you might abandon me too. And see, that's the deepest wound. Now, that's why, though, that we've got to be willing, and we'll start talking about this afternoon when we come back from lunch, the reason it's so important to get into a support group is because that's where you're going to start taking the risk of being vulnerable. And the only way you can learn to be intimate is to risk being vulnerable. And see, I can't ever get there unless I'm willing to take a risk. And so that risk becomes a crucial part of the healing. And sometimes you just have to act yourself into a right way of thinking and feeling rather than try to feel or act yourself in. I mean, rather than try to think it out, you have to just go ahead and do it. Okay, it's time now to stop for lunch. And I hope a lot of you will write out this first step, that you'll get behaviors from your own life, your own specific examples, and that you'll write them out so that when you're finished and you look at those sheets of paper, you will have a profound feeling of what codependency does to your life. Afternoon, we want to shift gears a bit and begin to really talk about recovery and the process of recovery, and I'm going to focus on one aspect of recovery, which I think is an important aspect. We do a lot of it in our center. We have a new family life, what is called a New Life Family Workshop, which is modeled after the compulsivity clinics in Minnesota. The farm we used was developed in the farm, we have it now, by Terry Kellogg. A lot of the same kind of work is going on at the Meadows in Wickenburg, Arizona, and Sierra Tucson. There's quite a networking of information that has come together, and I'm going to be sharing one aspect of that. A couple of things that I want to say before I get into the specific topic of what I call a second level of recovery, working on the family system. And I'll talk about first level of recovery in just a second. But there were a couple of questions that came up last night that I really feel are important as a kind of a framework for everything. One of the questions says, once we're taking
We're taking care of ourselves in appropriate ways. What can we do about dear old dad, 72, controlling, angry, critical, emotionally abusive, short of telling him not to attend family functions anymore? And there's another one. How do I hand back the pathology? My mother is reacting almost violently to my developing my reality and individuality. I don't know how to continue my growth. Well, those two questions especially, there is a sense that in the beginning of this work, you've got to put physical distance between yourself and your family. You've got a lot of people here get into this kind of work and they want to go back and confront their families and confront their mother, confront their dad. And I'm going to tell you, that's not what we recommend at all. Don't leave here tonight and go call your parent on the phone and say, you know what you did to me? Because that just doesn't work. And that isn't what this work is about. It's not about blaming people. It's about a forgiveness process. It's about a process of getting in touch with your own reality. Almost all the work we do with parents in our center is symbolic work. We do it with gestalt therapy, putting dad in an empty chair and talking to him in the chair, or putting mama in the chair, or role-playing, or doing internal remapping exercises, or working on the family system map and working out the roles like we'll do this afternoon. But you don't go to a parent. Now, there's some exceptions to that. At certain point of the work, incest victims, I often recommend that they do confront their offender. But I recommend that they be sure they have a lot of security and a lot of support, and that, you know, they're safe enough to do that. In the beginning, you really have to separate from your family, though. It's almost like when you're in that system, you're bonded to it. And the bonding is very, very powerful. It's very hard to break up these systems. Any of you who work clinically and work with families or know how difficult it is and how that family will suck that person back in very, very quickly. And how powerful families are. That's why a lot of people do not want to work one therapist against the whole family system, because it's very, very tough. Renee Fredrickson, who's a great leader and pioneer in sexual addiction and sexual abuse work, was once asked, what are the gifts that you would give your clients? And I don't know whether this is totally correct, but this is what the person that asked her that told me that she said. She said, I would give you, what are the gifts I would give my clients? I would give them the freedom to stop trying to fix their families, would be one of the gifts. And the second gift would be, in some cases, I would give you the courage to leave your family to their fate. Now that is hard, and especially if you're in the early stages of this, that sounds so cold and so hard. But sometimes you do. A father who is still an offender, who's coming there and destroying everybody's time, who's still creating the dysfunction that he's created all his life, that the daughter is in working on herself or the rest of the family has been in therapy, but he's not willing to do anything. See, we didn't come into this world to please our father or mother. We came into this world to be ourselves. The poet Gerard Manley Hopkins says, "What I do is me, for that I came." In the context of God, I came here in whatever sense of eternal mission I had or whatever, but I came here to be me. I did not come into this world to take care of my mother's emotions or my mother. Basically, my mother was supposed to have taken care of me for a period of my life and give me a start. So there is really a sense for some of you that you may have to leave your family to their fate.
Answer, yes, don't have daddy at the family reunions. He'll start getting the picture fairly quickly. And when that system quits enabling him, see, if we have daddy at the family and let him rage and let him be emotionally abusive, then we're just enabling him. We just allow him to go on being an offender. Now, it's very hard sometimes to get the rest of the family to be willing to do that. But, you know, really a father like this, intervention is in order. This is a sick person. Intervention is in order. And I'm not telling a family to do that. And I can't tell anybody exactly what to do with that, but I know that my life is too short, and every year that I get older, I get it, that I don't have time to spend in toxic relationships. I am not going to spend time in toxic relationships, and I don't care if they happen to be mama, grandmother, whoever. I'm going to find nourishing relationships. And that, to me, is the most important thing in my life. So Sharon Wechsleiter Cruz talks about finding a family of choice. And the first stage, in my opinion, of recovery is finding a family of choice, or finding a family of affiliation. I call it a family of affiliation. Sharon Wechsleiter calls it a family of choice. But what it means is that you find a place where you can go and not be shamed, where you can go and be accepted and be allowed to express your feelings, where other people share their feelings, that they're willing to be vulnerable with you. Where are these places? 12-step groups offer this kind of thing. The codependency groups, the ACOA groups, psychotherapy groups can often be a place like that. I suggested last night you may find it in a church group. Sometimes church groups have a tendency to be shaming and judgmental, so and somewhat rigid. But I think, I know people that find a lot of solace and a lot of healing in their groups, or in your, you know, whatever, in your meditation group, or in your unity consciousness group, or whatever. But it's a place where you can go, you can have mirroring. That is, people are there for you. You're accepted for the very one that you are. You don't have to play a role or a script or a game. Now, of course, that may not be where you work. You may need to have that group because where you work, you can't get real. It just isn't safe to get real there. And I'm not suggesting that you do. I'm suggesting that there are some times where you do have to play those games. Sometimes, you know, if you can find a way not to, if you're willing to take certain risks, then you can change that. But for the most part, there will be places in our life where you don't take those risks. But everyone needs a place in their life where it's a functional family, where there's real healing and real health going on. And so I just recommend that more than anything, that you come out of hiding, and one of the ways to come out of hiding is to find a family of affiliation. And I think that for many of us, for a couple of years, it's enough just to be in that family of affiliation, to be sharing, to hear people talking about their issues honestly, to be able to go and talk about what you feel. And that, you know, for many people, that's enough. I was in alcohol recovery 5 years before I ever dealt with any of these others, and really 10 years. I think if you've had a serious ingestive addiction, that you might need to work 2 to 5 years on that before you go into what I'm going to call second level work, or heavy therapy kind of work. And some people may not need to go, because you see, somebody asked the question, are all families dysfunctional? Is there any healthy family? You know, after you get through with people, Bradshaw, there's no healthy families. Well, what I said last night, I think our culture carries a lot of diseased attitudes like a virus, and that we are the product of our culture, and that the rules that govern parenting, our sex roles, are 150 years out of date. So one of the reasons why so many people can identify with this codependency is because of the rules that we have been using to create families with that are changing. They're not bad people, they're bad rules. A healthy group of affiliation is a way that you begin to change those rules. They're not rules about control, they're rules about live and let live. Our strength is in our individuality and in our differences. But our differences are what make our strength. And so we allow people to be different. I think the hardest thing any of us will ever have to work through in our life, in our marriage, is our differences. When you're in love, you don't notice any differences. You're out of your gourd. You minimize all the differences. When you get married, here comes the Hatfields and the McCoys. And now you have to deal with differences. The more shame-based I am, the harder it is for me to accept anybody's differences, because every difference becomes a threat. And one of my own gauges of my own mental health is how I accept people who are not like me and just say they're different. They're not right or wrong, they're different. Instead of what I used to say is they're weird. You know, if you're not like me, you're weird. So learning how to accept differences. First level recovery means really getting at that disabled will and starting to live a day at a time and take control of the only thing that you really have control of in your life, and that's yourself. And I love that living one day at a time. I learned that in AA, the idea that every yesterday is but a dream and every tomorrow is a vision, but today well lived makes every yesterday a dream of happiness and every tomorrow a vision of hope. That all I really can handle is 1 8-hour period. And sometimes I have to break it down into 1 minute, 1 15 minutes, 1 30 minutes. But the first level of recovery is really restoring that disabled will, getting you grounded back in reality, having some kind of family of affiliation, and for many of us, leaving those families of origin until we can do enough work to build strong enough boundaries to be able to go back to those families. Now, once you've built some strong boundaries, you've gone through your forgiveness process, you've grown up, you can go back to the family. Because when I'm grown up and I have good boundaries, I have my own opinions, I have my own beliefs, I have my own values, I become my own person. In the life cycle for normal people, this probably doesn't happen until you're about 40. I've got tapes I do on middle-aged crazies and what starts happening to people in midlife. And part of midlife is leaving home. There's a very powerful scripture that says, I have not come to bring peace but a sword. I've come to put sons against fathers, daughters against mothers. A man's foes shall be those of his own household. Matthew 10:34. That's not preached a lot, by the way, for obvious reasons. See, what it means is that until I'm through with those source relationships, I can't be the person I was meant to be. I'm not my own self until I have dealt with those source relationships. What does that mean? Grow up. That's all it means, is growing up, leaving home, saying goodbye, becoming your own person, having your own feelings, your own needs, your own wants. Not what has been legislated to you. Not what has been the roles and the scripts you play out of those family systems. So the first level of recovery is finding a family of affiliation or a family of choice. And I am, myself, I just am adamant with the people I work with that they get into groups. that they find groups, because that's what I never wanted to do. I wanted to be hypnotized. See, because my relational issues, I didn't want to come out of hiding. And there's something that happens in groups that doesn't happen anywhere else. And I said last night that the therapy of choice for codependency is to be in a group, because that's when your codependency will come out, in relationships. I wanted to be hypnotized. I didn't want to be in groups, because groups are exposure. I can't believe what's happened to me sitting in groups. I can remember talking so many times, talking and not even knowing how sad I was and just starting to cry. Or I remember one time in a group I was in, a share group of men, just a feedback group, not a therapy group, but just a group where you give each other feedback. What do you see? What do you hear? You know, a guy in my group the other day was talking about how he'd accepted his wife's affairs and his hands were white knuckled and his, you know, and his jaws were all tense. So the feedback is, Joe, when you talk about accepting your wife's affair, I see that your jaws are tense and your knuckles are white, and it doesn't look like to me that you've accepted it. Now, he can do what he wants with that. Feedback's a gift. It's like a pair of socks I give you. You can try them on. If you don't like them, don't use them. However, six other people in the group gave him the same feedback. When seven people look at you and give you the feedback, because you see, a lot of times there are things we do that we don't know, because we're in hiding. And the only way you can know is by to have the mirroring face of another person there. That's what we didn't get, a lot of us, in our narcissistic deprivation. So why be in a group? Because you can con, any therapist can be conned, but you're going to have a heck of a time doing a whole group. You'll just have a hard time doing a whole group. And as that group gives you feedback, you're getting a gift. Because I cannot know what I don't know. And when I'm in my defenses, I don't know some of these things. They're automatic and unconscious. So groups are very powerful. I remember another group I was in where I was talking about some stuff I did in my drinking days, and I was kind of grinning when I was saying it. And one of the guys in the group said, John, would you say that again, but this time don't smile while you're saying it. And see, it's like when I let go of these muscles, I just started weeping. Because this is the way I kept myself from the sadness. See, remember, emotions are energy. So how do you stop an emotion? You stop it with muscle tension. You stop it with a hallucination. You stop it with shallow breathing. And that's why, for example, when you meditate, or when you get real relaxed, boy, those emotions will start coming up. And so there are, in other words, by learning to smile, and I'll have this in counseling all the time. People are sitting there telling me this horrible stuff, and they're smiling. They're smiling while they're telling you. You know how terrible this marriage is, and they're smiling, or kind of nervously laughing. See, these are all cover-ups. And you can't know what you don't know. And you can't heal what isn't real. You can't heal what you can't feel. So if you're covering up your feelings with defenses, then a group, something happens in a group where all those faces are there. And you come out of hiding. So I just can't stress enough the importance of being willing to go to a group. And it's what a lot of us fear. I mean, I hated going to groups. I didn't want to tell those people my stuff and a bunch of people just sitting around talking about negative things and all this, all kind of defenses that come up about that. But I guarantee you, you need some kind of source and network. And one other thing, a lot of you are single parents, and so I start talking about surrogate spousing, and here you are with a little boy. It's just you and him. Well, what any single parent needs to hear, if my mom could have had an Al-Anon codependency group of people her own age, it would have gone a long way to not have me take on the emotional caretaking role. In other words, what you need is a group. You need a friend. You need affiliates where you can talk to them as adult to adult so that this little child doesn't get enmeshed into the divorce. That the child can have a relationship with mother and a relationship with dad. Or if dad's not there, a relationship with an uncle or a teacher or whatever. So that single parents don't have to panic, the important thing is to take care of your needs in appropriate ways and not be bringing those so that the kids have to take care of them or that your child has to take care of them. Because little children will naturally try to protect their parents for their own survival. You know, I remember my son, he would go around, and any time I had a frown on my face, when he was about 2 years old, he'd come up and tweak my face so it would look like a smile. He just knew it was safer around there when the old man was smiling. Okay? So that first level, and if you look at the notes I gave you where I have the circle,